This week in Retronauts, we're axiomatic. Everyone, and welcome to another fine episode of Retronauts. I'm Jeremy Parrish hosting this week. Bob is not here, and that's because this is a Skype-based recording session, and I'm on the line with two other people. If we tried to get a fourth in here, it would be chaos. So, in addition to myself this week, we also have the creator and publisher of Axiom Verge. Why don't you guys introduce yourself, Tom?
Hi, I'm Tom Happ, the creator and publisher of Axiom Verge.
And who else is here?
So this is me, Dan Edelman. So I've been working with Tom for about, it's been 3.5 years now or so. I don't know, 3 years. And we've been working together. So Tom made 100% of everything in Axiom Verge, and I just try to help him make a business out of it.
Okay, so I guess it wouldn't be fair to call you the publisher. It does say Thomas Happ Games as the copyright indicia. So so it's self-published. And Dan, you're more like the midwife, I guess.
The way I think of it is I'm the business guy on the team. So if it were a two-person studio, like Tom would be in charge of development and I would be in charge of business. But the way we've got it structured in a legal sense is that we're two separate companies, but for all intents and purposes, I think we kind of work as a team, and I handle the business stuff, and Tom handles all of the game development stuff.
Right, and I think I guess my confusion there was because of the recent news that quote unquote the publisher is donating 75% of profits of Axiom Verge to Thomas's his son's needs. So I guess that's how does that work exactly, if that's something you're okay talking about?
Sure, that's absolutely.
The physical publisher is Badland Games. So they're the publisher of the retail versions and the multiverse edition of the game.
Got it. Okay. I have not had a chance to check out everything in the multiverse edition yet, but it's a nice package. It's great to get... You know, a game like this kind of, it's interesting how games have these unconventional life cycles these days. It used to be like a game would come out at retail and then maybe it would show up on like Virtual Console or PSN or something later. But now we're getting a lot of games that show up as digital releases and then make their way to stores and retailers sort of after the fact. So it's nice to, you know, kind of have the physical token of this game's existence, I guess.
Yeah, I think increasingly, you know, things are going more and more digital, and you know, and that makes a lot of sense for not only smaller indie developers but also larger publishers. You're seeing them launching on digital day and date, which was unthinkable even like 5 years ago. But nowadays, it, you know, just without having to worry about manufacturing costs and inventory costs and all of this stuff, it's actually much better to release first digitally. And then once you have a good sense of like how big the fan base is, what kind of demand there is, then there's certainly a big group of people out there who still love physical media and they are willing to pay for it. And then, you know, you can definitely satisfy that need, but it also removes a lot of the risk associated with placing that order for cartridges and discs without having any idea if people are even going to care about the game. So, it actually helps give a lot more information about, how much, risk you're going to take on when you go physical.
Right. Yeah. I had never actually heard of Badland Games until, the multiverse edition of Axiom Verge was announced. I'm not familiar with them. Have they been around for a while? Like, what else have they done?
So probably the biggest thing that they're known for is they, I think they handled all of the Telltale physical releases.
Okay.
And they've also done Ali Ali 2, The Sexy Brutal, and they're working on Velocity 2X. I believe that's not out yet, but they're also publishing that at retail.
Okay, so it's a bunch of games I've heard of and seen, but did not associate the name with them. So that's on me, I guess.
Yeah, and you know, and I think that's fair, because I think Badlands' model is that they're working with known IPs, I think, for the most part. I think, actually, I take that back. If I recall correctly, they may have their own internally developed IPs or games that they are funding and doing a more traditional publishing pass on. But I think they're working on a lot of other games that have already existed in the market and maybe were self-published digitally, like Axiom Verge was, and then saying, okay, how do we take this game and bring it to retail?
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, you know, Axiom Verge debuted less than 3 years ago, so technically it's not a retro game, but I feel like it very much fits within the sort of sphere of Retronauts as a podcast, based on the fact that the game clearly embraces its roots, and those roots go back at least 30 years at this point, you know, to the original Metroid, and I don't know, maybe there's even older influences in there as well. So I'm really interested in talking to you guys, and especially Tom, about sort of the genesis of the game, the inspirations that you kind of drew from, and, you know, what you tried to bring to the pretty well-established Metroidvania-type mold at this point. You know, it's a pretty well-defined territory creatively, so kind of finding a way to express those ideas in a new and fresh way while still, you know, feeling true to the heritage there. That's a tricky balance to walk. And I feel like Axiom Verge pulls it off really well. And so I'm curious, you know, just would like to talk about that whole thing. To begin with, what was the genesis of Axiom Verge? Like, what made you sit down and decide, I need to make this game?
So really, it was kind of, it's a little bit about trying to capture that feeling of being a kid again and playing those classic games. But, you know, since, you know, time has evolved and, you know, when we sit down in front of an NES, it's no longer a miracle of technology. It's no longer the latest and greatest thing. We have all these other associations that to like capture that same feeling of playing an old NES game for the first time, it does require a lot of finesse and a lot of changes. And so that's kind of what I was going for, was seeing what I can do to have it still feel the same without having it feel dated, you know, for, you know, your rose colored memories are always, or often anyway, much better than what the actual fact is when you sit down in front of your NES and play some game that you have such fond, you know, recollections of, and in the present day, you go back to play it and it's sort of like, you know, how did I ever like this a lot of times? Or, you know, maybe it's a lot easier or much shorter, or a lot harder, you know, that kind of thing. So I was sort of trying to bring that feeling out. I wasn't necessarily going for Metroid in the beginning. I really wanted to take the best parts of all my favorite classic games. It's just that after developing it for a while, the more and more there was in the game, the more I started to realize that the Metroid esque elements were the ones that were sticking and the ones that were more, you know, away from that. I'd actually envisioned more like melee driven combat, kind of like Rygar, and that kind of went away over time. So that's why it has such a strong, like, Metroid leaning.
So you said you wanted to bring back, you know, the sense of childhood wonder, but I feel like you're really speaking to our childhood, like people, you know, of a certain age, if you want to say it that way. So you know, like for people who didn't necessarily cut their teeth on the NES, who maybe came along with the Super NES, or, you know, their first game was Smash Brothers on N64. How did you, like, did you think about that audience as well? Like, did you, do you have any thoughts on what this game might offer them? Like, what kind of resonance it might have with people who don't have the NES as a touchstone?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, probably the primary thing I was trying to capture was that sense of discovery in those old games. I don't know, maybe by way of comparison, in new games, exploration and finding objects is largely handled by something new pops up on the map to let you know that you should go there, or, you know, something is glowing in the environment to let you know you should walk towards the glowing thing. Whereas we had never, you know, the game industry as a whole had never learned that kind of thing back then. So it was more in the vein of, you know, Zelda, where you have to use your bombs on every single wall to find out, you know, where there might be a hole, or where the wall you might be able to just be walked through like it's invisible. And I didn't want it to be as annoying as that is, but I still wanted to have that feeling like any block in the game world could be something. I try to design the game to where, you know, your eye will be drawn to those blocks without necessarily, you know, having it have a big crack through it to let you know that it's supposed to be bombable, or, you know, not that there's bombs in Axiom Verge, but that's that idea. So kind of trying to make it easier for modern players to get that same sense of exploration without it being the more characteristic of modern day, where the thing you're exploring is either told to you, or, you know, stands out with, you know, a glow, or, you know, some like an icon or something like that, which I feel kind of makes it feel less natural in a way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like that's a really, really difficult tightrope to walk. I feel like very few people walk it effectively. And try to find the right balance. You know, like you say, you know, so many games just sort of hand everything to you and say, this is where you're going. But on the other hand, like, I am not eager to go back to the Metroid days, the original Metroid, where, like, I literally was stuck for a month when I first played the game until I figured out, oh, if I bomb certain places of the floor that are completely innocuous and have no reason for me to bomb there, then I will find hidden passages. So yeah, that happy medium, that seems really tough to hit.
Yeah, and one thing I'll just chime in. So there are a couple things that I think Axiom Verge does particularly well in that regard. One is that it kind of teaches players about those kinds of hidden secrets without a tutorial or without hitting them over the head. So like a really good early example is when you get the drill, for example. You get the drill after beating the first boss, and there are some blocks that look like, you know, you can drill them. So they look like rocks, and you drill them, and sure enough, you can get through them. And then as you progress a little bit further, right behind some blocks, some regular rocks that you've already been taught can be drilled, you find some regular looking blocks, and sure enough, those two can be drilled and broken up. And so you kind of realize, like, it's not just the blocks or the rocks, it's other types of tile sets can also potentially be drilled through, and some can and some can't. So it kind of lets you know that is possible. And another thing that I think it does well is that, as far as I can recall, there's no place where you are blocked if you don't recognize some of the, you know, like if you don't explore and find some of these things that don't look like they should be destructible, but they turn out they are. Usually those things will lead to different secrets and power-ups and things like that. But in terms of actually progressing through the game, I believe everything in there is something that follows kind of the more traditional rules that you've been taught in the game, if that distinction makes sense. So the experimentation isn't required to beat the game, but the more you experiment and explore, the more of the secrets and the good stuff you can find along the way.
Yeah, that was actually a hard lesson for me. There's a story about that very thing with the drill that you're talking about. I don't remember how this happened, but somehow Jonathan Blow, the famous developer of Braid, got a hold of the game and was direct messaging me over Twitter about his experience. And he, you know, it was prior to me adding that little chamber where you're forced to learn how to use the drill on different blocks. And he just totally did not get it. And there was, you know, there's an area before you get to Elsinova where there's at least two different pathways you can take that you use the drill. And he couldn't figure out any of them. And I think it basically ruined the game for him. I don't think he played beyond that point. So I was like, oh my God, I've got to do something about this. So, it's sort of a thing that you happen across whenever you find a new ability or something. There's always a part where I try to trap you in there and force the player to learn how to use it in as many ways as I can think of so that, you know, they won't forget that they can do that again later on, which of course they do anyway, but I try.
Yeah. That's something that I think sort of became part of the exploratory platformer vocabulary with Super Metroid, where you would have to use the newly acquired power up that Samus just equipped in order to get out of the room that she you know picked it up in. But I don't think people really sort of cottoned to that as a deliberate design decision by Nintendo until later, like many years later. I started seeing other people start to do it, so I feel like it's something that's just like, they did it a long time ago and no one else really noticed. And then it's kind of become, you know, a more common element of games like this where, you know, you force players to stop and say, wait, I need to use this tool somehow to get out of where I've gotten stuck. With that said, like, the game still sort of places a lot of expectation on the player. I'm speaking specifically of Axiom Verge, to kind of keep all these things in mind. And as we've seen with, you know, like, why can't Metroid crawl and that sort of thing, like that is a lot to ask of players who are used to having everything handed to them and to have tooltips pop up and to have, you know, a voice in their ear constantly say, you know, now you need to go to the control chamber or something along those lines. Was there a temptation to insert yourself into the game or to offer like some sort of live hint system or something, you know, to kind of hold players by the hand if they got stuck? Or did you really feel it was important to stick to your guns and say, like, this is how it's designed and this is what they need to figure out?
I think it was fairly easy for me to stick to my guns. I did sort of envision originally there being more dialogue, and perhaps even like something akin to that ongoing banter that you see in a lot of modern games these days, where there's, you know, conversation playing as you're playing the game. But it wasn't centered around like tool tippy type things. It was more just for story purposes, or maybe to like acknowledge, you know, how the character is feeling in this really, you know, what would be in real life a very like terrifying situation, and not just seem, you know, like he's just standing still or running as if there's nothing going on. But I think I don't know, that when I showed my earliest versions of the game to players and there was a lot of dialogue, everyone was universally like, no, like not so much dialogue, take it out. So that's kind of how it got to be where it is.
Okay. Yeah, even the dialogue that remains, that seems to be the biggest complaint that I've seen people direct at the game, is that there's a lot of, you know, sort of internal monologue. And I think, you know, this game does evoke Metroid so much that they sort of want the sort of silent, just get lost in a world sort of feeling that that Metroid brings, or at least brought, you know, before it got really chatty with Fusion and Other M.
Yeah, I've actually heard the opposite complaint, which is that people wanted to know more about the story and kind of wished there were a little bit more story elements and text involved. And so there are a few cutscenes where the story is told through and some, you know, a little bit of internal monologue. But yeah, a lot of people have said that they wanted more of that. So I guess, you know, the end conclusion is you'll never be able to satisfy everyone. So,
yeah. And my response to that was kind of like speedrun mode where there's no dialogue, but
yep.
I think people didn't really catch on to the fact that you can play it without any dialogue or story if you like,
right.
Or maybe they just don't like having, you know, feeling rushed because now it's quote unquote speedrun mode. And even though you don't have to rush, it maybe gives that feeling.
Yeah, like Dan said, I guess you can't really satisfy everyone, and everyone sort of comes into games with their own expectations and biases, especially when a game sort of, you know, hints at its roots and its inspirations. It kind of leads people to expect certain things. So it seems like that might be, you know, one of the big challenges is managing people's expectations or just saying, I just got to make the game I got to make.
And I think it's definitely the latter. And a lot of developers ask me for advice and, you know, and over the years. And one of the things that I've consistently told them is, you know, first start off with building what it is you want to build. And then, you know, then put it in front of people and see where people get frustrated, stuck, confused. You know, those kinds of things are not positives. So the thing like with the drilling the blocks and Jonathan Blow not understanding how to proceed through the game, that's a really good lesson to learn. But when Tom decided to design the game that he wanted to play, where it was all about exploration and not holding the player's hand, you know, that is something that I think the game turned out really well because he designed it the way he had always intended. Because otherwise you get something that's kind of designed by marketing as opposed to informed by marketing, which is a very different approach. So it's much better to have a small group of people, like-minded people who absolutely love your game because they've been waiting for something exactly like this for years, rather than a whole bunch of people who are like, yeah, this game's okay. It's just like a bunch of other games, but it's okay.
Yeah, I guess that, you know, that's one of the advantages of a game designed by one person is that it doesn't have to be a 10 million selling blockbuster in order to be a success. I assume that at this point, Axiom Verge is definitely a success for you guys. Whereas, you know, you read about like Tomb Raider games selling 5 million copies, 7 million copies, and Square Enix is like, yeah, that didn't do so great. Really? 7 million wasn't great? Okay. So I guess that's probably somewhat liberating to a degree.
It is, you know, it really allows me to kind of have the mindset of I'm just trying to make something that's fun and have fun while I'm doing it, you know, not be beholden to some like external idea of what would be fun. You know, I've worked for big companies before and I've I've had them tell me like, no, your idea just would not be marketable. Not even having that be a factor is great.
Now, you mentioned that you started out with Axiom Verge having more like melee combat in mind and not necessarily leaning so much on Metroid in terms of its inspiration. I remember, the very first trailer I saw, there was a really strong Contra vibe to it, and that never really totally went away, but I definitely do feel like the exploratory Metroid element is kind of what dominated. Can you walk us through how it sort of evolved from, something more more melee focused, the Rygar-ish game to what it ended up being?
So initially my thought was like, what I will take from Metroid would be like the overall world map design, how it's everything is interconnected and there's some backtracking and exploring to find new weapons. And then, the moment-to-moment gameplay, I want it to be more responsive. So that's a bit like, how Contra fits in there. In the very beginning, I had wanted it to be, I'd envisioned it actually, like you said, like Rygar. So I actually have drawings of, Trace where he has like this sort of instead of the bug gun, it's like a bug that's attached to his arm. I think it was actually sort of squid like looking and, could shoot out its tentacles at things. And there were some variations on that, like that the tentacles that were on his back were originally, but before I ever drew them, I wanted them to be something that he could swing out like a whip, or that could be used to like climb around and that kind of thing. Where I got further and further away from it was that, I basically just started like writing down ideas for items and weapons. And I had so many ideas for different kinds of guns. When I say it like that, it sounds lame, but I was actually thinking of if you ever played Star Control on the Sega Genesis and Star Control 2, where you have each of these spaceships has just such a completely different arsenal. Like there's, there's the one that shoots out a single pellet that explodes into multiple pellets. And that same ship would be in firefights with another guy that just has like a small ray of destruction. And then each of those ships always has secondary weapons. Like, there's one ship that can launch out little mini ships. There's another ship that can suck the crew out with their siren calls. There's another ship that can teleport and all these different kinds of things. And a lot of those differences that I really liked had to do with how the projectiles work. And I didn't want to limit myself by saying, okay, he has this thing that works a little bit like the disc armor or like Kratos's chains, because, no matter what you do, those are always a thing that's attached to a tether of some kind that the player swings out. And if I change it too much, then I basically have to change the way enemies are, take damage, the way the player animates when he swings, and that kind of thing, to have all the different variations I wanted. So I was like, okay, if I just have it so that he has this gun, then I can really like have each projectile or whatever be a completely different object and kind of like encapsulate its behavior separately without it being tied back to the player and, how the character looks in any way. So that was the first part of that, I think. The other part was that when I actually started programming the game and, having parts in there, I realized that I wanted to have the destructible bricks, or bricks that have different properties. Like some of them can come back, some of them are glitched or whatever. And I think that also like is better served by projectiles, something that's small and fits in that 16 by 16, area and is very like well communicated, like what you're, you know, for example, if you shoot a bullet at a wall and the bullet is stopped by the wall, you see exactly where it stopped, or, you know, which if the wall is transparent, you know, where the wall is transparent, where it's not, and that kind of thing. So, so those things kind of combined, you know, to where now instead of being a melee game where maybe the environments are more continuous looking like Rygar, it became a missile-based game, and then the environments look more block-shaped like in the original Metroid. So that's sort of like where it gets that whole flavor from.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned guns, because I feel like one of the things that really sets Axiom Verge apart from Metroid is that there is a pretty clear division between weapons and tools. Whereas in Metroid, basically anytime Samus gets a weapon, you know, whether it's the screw attack or a missile, it doubles as a tool for helping her to navigate. It's very rare that you acquire something that's just for, you know, just for navigating, just for managing the environment. Whereas in this game, you have things like the glitch gun, you have things like the drone, you have the ability to pass through walls that, you know, like those have some combat applications, but not nearly to the degree of, you know, like the standard guns that you're carrying around. Can you talk about how some of those ideas developed, especially the glitch gun, which I think is really the unique element, or one of the unique elements of Axiom Verge that kind of it sets it apart, and also it just feels like such an acknowledgement of the experience of playing these games, you know, like sticking a cartridge into the system and it was a little dirty, so you get weird graphics and stuff like that. It was like taking that and turning it into a game mechanic. And I'm curious about, you know, sort of the inspirations for those.
So my separation between weapons and tools was something that came out, or that I came up with before I'd ever thought about having a glitch gun. And the reason for that was that one of the flaws that I thought I perceived in games like Super Metroid and others was where a lot of your exploration ends up being rewarded by yet another missile tank or yet another energy tank. And I'd always felt like Symphony of the Night, for example, had more interesting exploration because the things you found would be like completely new and unique weapons, rather than it did have expansions, but it also had just a ton of weapons and armor. And so I was trying to kind of find a middle ground there. So that's where I came up with the idea. Well, there will be a whole bunch of weapons in this game. And while the tools can be used as weapons sometimes, not all the weapons can be used as tools. I think there's just like two weapons that could be used that way. So that's how that came about. And whether it was successful or not is kind of up for grabs. A lot of people say that there's too many weapons, you know, so that it makes the weapons not feel as special. Also, I ended up putting lore in the environment. So then a lot of people were like, well, you know, I did all this exploring and all I did was get a piece of lore, which is exactly what I said, you know, about like the missile expansions in Metroid. So I ended up falling into the same trap while doing extra work to do it. So that's kind of how that separation came about. And then for the glitch ray, I'd say that was really... I don't know. I can't claim that I had been planning for that to be in all along. I think I had been working on the game for a year and a half or something before that even occurred to me. And what it really was I was trying to figure out how I can get things like the secret worlds or like, you know, the Justin Bailey passcode and all those various things. And I don't know, maybe I was thinking about, well, you know, there's this focus. Like for a while, there was this craze, like everything had to have a special gun, Portal has the Portal gun and Half-Life has the gravity gun. And there were sort of other games coming out. There's a gun that scales things up and down, or here's a gun that reverses gravity. And so I think maybe that, you know, kind of fed into my subconscious, like, you know, the gun is the way that you cause the glitches to happen. But I don't think there was any one, reason or moment that it came. It just sort of like was an epiphany one day, like, I could do this and it would let me have all of these different features in one.
Maybe going the same place you were. I know, Tom, you've talked a lot about how like you used to play around with Game Genie and things like that, and you had a lot of fun finding like hidden things in the game cartridge that were never meant to be seen by end players. Was that part of your inspiration, or maybe the thought came to you first of using these glitches, and then it went from there?
It all was like one thought, you know, that the Game Genie, the password, the dirty cartridge, all of those things were really just like one thing to me, and how I was going to do that. And I ended up splitting it, you know, between the glitch ray, the password tool, and the secret worlds. But yeah, I mean, as a kid, you know, a lot of NES games were rather short. Even the original Metroid was. So the most played, you know, I spent most of my time playing that, I think, was just, you know, doing the wall jump in the original Metroid to get to the secret worlds and exploring there. And I had no idea that it was just based on, you know, how the cartridge was interpreting unused portions of memory. So I thought that there was like an infinite world to be found in there. And I never knew how I could capture that feeling. So, you know, it was just one of many things, I think, to try and convey that.
Yeah, that's something that I did a lot too. You know, I had like two games for my NES for a while, Super Mario Brothers, which I was sick of because I played it so much, and Metroid. And, you know, the Nintendo Fun Club newsletter, which showed off the secret worlds, quote unquote, made it seem like it was a deliberate design decision. Like they presented it as if there were all these worlds that you could spelunk, like all these hidden things the developers didn't want you to know about. So I think the way Nintendo marketing and, you know, the people writing the Fun Club newsletter presented it added to that allure. You know, they kind of pulled the wool over our eyes, not in a malicious way, but just to kind of increase the, honestly, probably just to come up with something to say about what amounts to a simple little glitch in the game, a little exploit. But yeah, that's really something that Axiom Verge captures. And you mentioned the secret worlds. And those are really fascinating because they feel so alien and hostile. Like there was that sense in NES games like Metroid and Life Force, you know, that you were someplace that you weren't supposed to be. Like these were alien, scary worlds, and there was no real explanation for them. You know, it was whatever you read in the manual, or maybe like two sentences on the attract mode. And that was all the context you had for these things. And that's something that I really like about Axiom Verge, is that even though there is a lot of lore in the game and there's narrative and dialogue, it's still like you fall into these weird pulsing places in the environment and you discover these things. And all of a sudden you're like, what the hell is going on? And it just, it really does capture that sense of like, you know, being a little kid and wondering like, what have I stumbled into?
It's definitely hard, like difficult to resist the urge to have the character be like, why am I in a room with, you know, pulsating heads, or, you know, explain every little thing in there. Even designing it, like I come up with explanations for what these things are. And then I'm like, but I can't ever talk about them because it would just probably destroy that, you know?
Yeah. I don't think games need to explain everything. I think you don't need for the protagonist to say, like, what is this place? I think, you know, if it's done effectively, the player is going to say, what is this place? And that's, you know, that sort of projection that you want into your video game protagonist. So in talking about, you know, your NES inspirations, the game visually draws very heavily on the NES, like the color palettes and the pixel art design and so forth, the size of the sprites. But obviously it doesn't stick to, you know, it's not slavishly faithful to the NES style. You didn't go with like 256 by 224 resolution. The screen zooms in and out and it has a very large pixel resolution effectively. So that's always something interesting to me is sort of how you approach, fidelity to source material without compromising the game and without sort of breaking the vibe that you're going for.
Yeah, that's, you know, it's definitely not being about, it's about not being slavish. I would say, I don't think that having the retro style is what made classic games fun necessarily. There are advantages to the limitations that they had that, you know, force the player to use their imagination and in a way like sort of create their own reality where once you suspended your disbelief, it's very consistent and in a lot of ways more real feeling than some very polished 3D, you know, modern games would be. And so I think what I was going for was to build in restrictions, but they didn't necessarily have to be, or limitations, but not necessarily the same limitations as an NES, you know. It might seem like the palette is limited, but it isn't really, you know, it's more like I try to make it so, you know, each little 8x8 element only used 4 colors plus black or 3 colors plus black. And I tried to make it look like large areas had repetitive tiling in them, you know, for, you know, on big monsters and that kind of thing. But that's more about creating self-consistency with the world and not creating consistency with NES games. So I don't feel like the resolution is too terribly important that it has to match NES resolution, or, you know, that the sound effects need to be precisely the NES, you know, 2 square waves and a triangle wave. As long as they have like a consistent feel, like they belong in this world together, if that makes any sense.
Right. Yeah. I think the word consistency is the key there. There's a lot of, you know, sort of retro chasing games that use a mishmash of visual styles, like sprites will be one style and then there'll be backgrounds that are much higher resolution. Double Dragon 4 was one of those. And, you know, I've seen a few others, Classic Dungeon or Cladon for PSP, I think. You're just like, what are you doing here? Whereas this, it feels like it's, you know, it's unified. Everything fits together, which I think is the most important thing. Did you consider looking or working with a different style other than NES? Like doing something more advanced, like Super NES style or Genesis? Or was your heart pretty well set on NES all the way through the project?
I had worked on Game Boy Advance games in the past. And there was even like a Metroid clone for the GBA called Orn, where it was kind of this mix between 16-bit and 8-bit styles. But I'd also certainly done 16-bit, and I've worked on AAA 3D games. I think the focus on the NES style was, it came about from two things. Like, one is that, this kind of environment where it's made out of the discrete blocks, and the blocks blockiness is important to the game, kind of the way it is in Minecraft, maybe not to the same extent, but, you know, certainly in terms of telegraphing to players what they can and cannot do. You know, the limited NES number of colors and tiles definitely fits in with that. You know, there's also just the plain, how long is it going to take me to make anything? So the more, I don't know what the word is. I don't want to say resolution, but the more just like overall detail you have to your graphic style. Say you want to make it look like an NES game. Well, you can no longer take the same 16x16 tile and use that over and over again if it's going to look like an NES game, because it will now, I don't know how this is, but to your eye, it now seems like a repeating pattern, as opposed to more like a pixel within a grander pattern. So that's had a lot to do with it too. So I didn't want to say increase the colors to 256 and then still use 16x16 tiles, because it would feel wrong to you. What you need, I think, is consistency, and the more detail you get, the more time you spend, you know, say you go away from having everything look like blocks. Now you've got to make sure, say it's terrain, that, you know, there's a tuft of grass on the top of the block and the bottom is dirt. And then, you know, so that it now fits in with the higher fidelity graphic style, you probably want to have slopes of different degrees, and you need transition tiles to go between those, and to go between where it's, you know, where the grass is vertical and there's a cliff face that's all dirt, and that kind of thing. And it actually makes it take a lot longer and has you run into issues like, okay, well, what if I want to have these blocks be drillable with the drill? Like, if one of those blocks in that seamless terrain that you designed is suddenly drilled away, it just becomes this sharp edge and looks wrong, because it's everything else is seamless except for where you drilled. Whereas in that NES style, it's like, oh, the terrain could have always looked this way, you know, once you've drilled out the block and made a cavity that is also blocked shape.
I hadn't really considered the sort of pragmatic applications of lower resolution graphics, but that's interesting to hear sort of the logic behind that, and it makes a lot of sense. I totally forgot about Ornn, by the way. That game never actually came out, did it?
No, it was just a school project, so it exists in ROM form, I believe, on the internet, and that's as much coming out as it's ever had.
Yeah, I don't know if someone showed me a link to it or if someone sent me a copy of it, but I do remember playing it. Now that I have a GBA EverDrive, I need to load that up and play it on actual hardware and kind of play it in, you know, the original intended format for it. So right before kind of the midpoint, I would like to ask one last question, and that's about the soundtrack, which you also composed yourself and performed. And that doesn't stick to NES restrictions at all. There's nothing like about that soundtrack that would make you say, oh yes, this was on an NES, even though it does have some of the, you know, like the square waves and triangle waves. It's definitely something, you know, kind of its own beast. Can you talk about the mode you were working with this for the soundtrack, and kind of how you ended up going in that direction?
I think kind of what you know, going back to Ornn, where the soundtrack to that game was made using Modplug, a tracker, and was fairly primitive. I think with Axiom Verge, I just, for the sake of making it more fun for me, I didn't want to have those limitations. So that's sort of where I went with the, you know, it's electronica, but not not necessarily chiptune. You know, there are some square waves in it, you know, in pretty much every song in there, but I didn't want to hold myself to it. And I was sort of like, well, you know, I don't know if this will fit with the game's visuals, and I don't care. I'm just going to do it. And, you know, I'll find out when people play it if they think it didn't belong. And I've had a couple of people say, like, I wish he had had someone else make the soundtrack because it, you know, it just didn't fit, or it was too dancey or whatever. But, you know, in the end, it was all about amusing myself, too. So, you know, that's that. I'd say, like, in terms of inspirations, the soundtrack is, you know, it's definitely inspired by NES Metroid and Super Metroid and Metroid Prime, but also, you know, just whatever music I happen to like, which is a lot of electronica, like Orbital, and there's this group called Hybrid that I really like. And, you know, I think when I was making the game, probably a lot of the music I was listening to at the time informed, you know, how the soundtrack came out in the end.
Yeah, I think a game as big as Axiom Verge is compared to, you know, the NES Metroid, I feel like if you had gone with just straight chiptunes, it would have felt really, it would have worn after a while. I mean, Metroid, it works because it's a pretty small game, but this is like two or three times the size of Metroid or bigger. And so I feel like you need something a little more laid back and chill in terms of ambiance for most of the exploration.
Yeah, I agree. There is definitely something very raw about chiptune. And, you know, when I do go in that direction, I find myself like, how can I smooth this out somehow and still have it be recognizable as, you know, chippy in some regard?
Just because you're listening to a video games podcast doesn't mean you have to eat like video gamer stereotypes. There are many more and many healthier meal options out there than hypercaffeinated soda and junk food. Consider supplementing that all pizza diet with a subscription to HelloFresh, a meal delivery kit service that brings you fresh food prep kits to your door. HelloFresh offers great convenience. They deliver food directly to your door in compact, insulated boxes. You can choose your delivery day in order to best fit your schedule, pause your account when you won't be around. All the ingredients come pre-measured in clearly labeled meal kits with simple instructions, so you know which ingredients go with which recipe. Every week, HelloFresh offers a new selection of chef-curated recipes from one of three plans to choose from. There's Classic, which includes a variety of meat, fish, and seasonal produce. Veggie, packed with plant-based proteins, grains, and seasonal produce for those who prefer a vegetarian diet. And Family, quick and easy meals crafted to please and feed an entire family. Most recipes I've tried from HelloFresh don't take much more than 30 minutes to prep and cook. There's also a 20-minute meal on the Classic menu each week for when you really don't have much time. Plus, many recipes can be made in one pot, which means you won't have to worry about endless cleanup. And if you prefer your food portable for your gaming lifestyle, the good news is that not everything from HelloFresh involves juggling lots of plates. I'm a fan of their classic Poblano beef chili, which is delicious, healthy, and fits neatly into a single bowl for convenience. Right now, HelloFresh is offering a special trial deal for Retronauts listeners so you can experience their quality for yourself. Get $30 off your first week of HelloFresh by visiting HelloFresh.com and entering the code Retronauts30. That's Retronauts30.
You know, when you're a kid, there are a lot of things that you think exist. Unicorns, dragons, mermaids, you name it. When you're a kid, it's real. But when you find out later that they don't, well, it's kind of disappointing. Of course, as you get older, you get over the disappointment. But when you're looking to buy a car, there's nothing worse than finding the one of your dreams online, and then you find out later it doesn't really exist. It's not true. That's why at TrueCar, they show you real pricing on actual inventory. This isn't pricing offered to you by TrueCar. It's an actual VIN-based price from a TrueCar certified dealer in your area. Real prices. And these aren't just any dealers either. TrueCar certified dealers are a carefully curated network of dealers committed to transparency. They offer competitive prices and a faster, easier buying experience for you. It's a fact. TrueCar customers are more likely to enjoy a faster buying process when they connect with the TrueCar certified dealers. And, on average, they save over $3,000 off the MSRP. So when you're ready to buy that dream car, visit TrueCar and enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features not available in all states.
Hey humans, David Smalley here from the Dogma Debate Podcast, right here on Podcast One, where we talk about all the things you're not supposed to discuss at work: religion, politics, abortion, racism, slavery, and that's only when we open the Bible. We discuss Islam, Islamophobia. What does that even mean? We chat with vegans, animal rights activists, and even visit factory farms to see it for ourselves. I invite people from multiple backgrounds to convert me into their worldview. But as long as they're okay with being respectfully challenged, you better bring your evidence. And I never lose sight of how both the left and the right are seeming to lose their minds. So basically, we're solving all the world's problems right here on Dogma Debate.
And you've been missing it.
Watch our 360 virtual reality videos on the Podcast One app and download Dogma Debate on iTunes, Stitcher, or PodcastOne.com.
All right, so we're going to jump into listener mail now. We got a whole bunch of emails from people who mostly are fans of Axiom Verge. There's a few slight criticisms here, but nothing too cruel. Yeah, we'll just we'll start with one of those, actually, one of the more critical ones from Zach Handlin. It took me a couple of tries to get sucked into Axiom Verge, but once I got hooked hard. The game is more challenging than Super Metroid, but it scratches the same itch, and the variety of weapons and bizarre enemy and location designs did a great job of creating a sustained mood of subtle wrongness that was really interesting to play through. It's also pure joy on the Switch. Unfortunately, the game's actual story, told through journals and intermittent dialogue, tries to do too much. I stopped playing about 3/4 of the way through, having already found most of the cool toys and beaten most of the bosses. All I had left to carry me forward was a need to resolve the plot. And since that plot was such a collection of big ideas, I had no interest in finishing it. Are there regrets about the narrative, or is this just a matter of personal taste?
I think I would say there are some regrets. You know, I think I alluded to early on how I had previewed the game. Someone, I think from GameSpot, maybe did a stream back in 2012. There was a whole thread about it in, I don't know if you remember NeoGAF.
I do.
Where a lot of people were like, oh my God, like the character just keeps on talking. You know, like, why did he say this? Why did he say that? He doesn't need to say that. He just needs to shut up and let the Metroid baby fly around the screen a little bit, and we'll know to care for that. I took that to heart, you know, and I really slashed the dialogue down to maybe a third of what I had planned at that point. So I always wonder, is it just that the story is not that engaging, or is it like I just didn't explain enough? And I've had a lot of people tell me they had no idea what was going on. And I think maybe that was a function of, you know, I tried to tell the story with as little back and forth as possible. I also took this this stance that the main character, Trace, would be smarter than me, or, you know, smarter, you know, he's supposed to be a brilliant scientist type of person. So he figures out things without telling anyone that he figured them out. So many, many plot points are not really explained, because I wanted you to have that feeling like the game is not treating you like a dummy, but also maybe even making you feel like maybe this character is a little bit smarter than you. in terms of like the lore, the little pieces that you find, I'd say almost none of them are directly related to the plot as you see it in this game. They're more like flavorings, you know, maybe things to set up like another future game or like things that happened in the past or just to like give you an idea of what this world is like, you know. So there's lots of lore in there that's in this Sumerian like text to kind of you know, convey like how the people living in this world might have talked, and then like, you know, dialogue between the Rusalki, you know, talking to each other, you know, sort of like just to give you the feel like, you know, these characters are sort of plotting, they can't move, you know, this, and they just kind of email each other basically, you know, through their thoughts, without it actually being a continuous thing where if you put every piece together, now you have the whole story. Cause that doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, the story does have a lot of kind of big concepts like Trace's relationship to the actual villain of the piece. And not all of that is necessarily spelled out explicitly, but I feel like I, you know, made the connections, fairly easily and figured out pretty much what was going on, but I did also go chasing after a lot of the lore. So maybe that was the difference.
Yeah, and I think one other thing, I think you hit the nail on the head that, you know, there's a lot of big ideas in the story, and I think there was that tension, as Tom mentioned, about how much story do you want to put in? Does it get in the way of the gameplay? But I know, like, Tom used to maintain a blog with all kinds of different thoughts about, you know, the nature of reality, what is real, what is the relationship between your mind and the physical reality? So there are a lot of deep ideas that, you know, it's tough. If you want to explore those fully, then that can pull you away from the gameplay. But if you focus too much on, you know, just the gameplay, then you come away with less of the story and the ideas that I think Tom was trying to communicate. But so I think that might be one of the reasons for people's complaints, was there's just so much there and Tom was trying to communicate that with so few words. But in answering kind of the what the letter writer said, I'd say, you know, if the player, that person got to a point in the game where they're like, I don't care about the story anymore, and that's the only thing keeping me going, you know, of course, that's fine. Everyone's different. But the thing that always kept me going, and, you know, and I've played it, I can't remember how many times I've played it at this point. To me, it's always about the exploration and finding, like, all right, what do I have to do next? How do I keep progressing? Where have I not explored yet? And where do I go next? And so that's, to me, more than even the story, is just like, how do I uncover all of this map? How do I get all of the items? How do I, you know, experiment with glitching all the enemies and seeing what they do? And to me, that's the thing that provides the momentum to follow through with the game all the way.
So from friend of the show, D Fight, as a dev working mostly solo, how hard was it to decide what content made the cut and what didn't? Did you commit to including all your ideas, hence the dozens of weapons and upgrades, lots of lore, a Bionic Commando arm, or were there things that just couldn't fit into the final product?
Well, first thing that comes to mind is the weapons. I had originally made a list of 100 weapons that I wanted, and I eventually pared them down because not so much that 100 was too much to make, which maybe it would have been, but just that it would have been too overwhelming. I would have had this, you know, have to have had a much more robust inventory management system in there. And I really wanted to, you know, be able to have you select your weapons with a weapon wheel or something like that. So, I did cut down on the weapons. There were some things, like there was a very, I think I might mention this in that documentary, where there was like a very grotesque kind of boss where it was sort of like Athatos finds a way to use Elsa Nova's body as a weapon. And I just took it out because not only was it like a disgusting idea, but I didn't really want, you know, even though Athatos is a villain, he's not that kind of villain. So, you know, not really the, it was almost like a, you know, like rape, like allegory. I didn't want it to be that. So, you know, that got cut, mainly for that reason. There was Athatos's, the final boss that you come to in the game was originally a different shape, but I realized in this end battle I wanted to be able to have Athatos and Elsa Nova both in the scene. So this boss I had designed, which was sort of like at the end of an underground corridor, wouldn't fit that at all. So I ended up, you know, just not using that design, period. But you can still see there's a way to glitch it so that you can find that boss, and he's somewhere near where the actual Athatos end boss is in the game. I'm trying to think of what else might have been in there. Like, as I said before, I wanted there to be more dialogue originally, and one of the things I had wanted was for there to be like a Metal Gear Solid style, what do you call that? It's like codec or something? It's like a radio.
Yeah, the codec.
Mm-hmm. And you have the heads on either side of the screen. And I thought, like, hey, like, what if you could ring up these characters at any time and have them talk? And I was sort of like, well, you know, I already wasn't sure about how important this is. And, you know, also, like, as I was developing the game, I realized just how little the Rusalki want Trace to know about what's going on. And I felt like those conversations would just be Trace being, why don't you tell me more? Why don't you tell me what's going on? Why aren't you saying anything? And them finding more and more reasons like not to reply. So it sort of, you know, to be silly, like, you know, these characters really want him to know the minimum to convince him to go on.
All right, so this letter is from Mike Kasich. It's not really a question, just a comment. Last week, I received my copy of the Switch Multiverse Edition, and I'm currently about a fifth of the way through the first playthrough, having read much praise for Axiom Verge, but knowing little about it, the game itself. So far, I'm blown away. Axiom Verge takes me back to my first playthrough of the original Metroid on real hardware, complete with palette and sprite glitching. I was floored when I stumbled onto a secret world, almost exactly like how I select glitched a hole in the wall in Metroid 2, except Axiom Verge didn't crash while I was exploring it. No other gaming experience in the past 25 years has elicited the same combination of anticipation, surprise, and nostalgia for the gaming experience itself. I'm completing this playthrough slowly to savor it, as I'm not sure if I'll ever have this kind of experience again. But from what I've seen so far, Axiom Verge is a meticulously crafted game that absolutely deserves the praise it receives. Thanks, Tom, for all your work on this fantastic game. Let's see.
I like that one.
Yeah, that was a good one.
That was a good one.
Yeah. From Brian Berg. Axiom Verge is a really cool game with some incredibly frustrating design decisions. I played in the on the PS4 around launch, and once I completed it, I didn't feel compelled to return. Let's see. I still think it's great. It's full of great ideas that are mostly well executed, but you really have to be in a certain kind of mood to enjoy it. I'd buy a sequel or spiritual follow-up for Mr. Happ if he promised to improve fast travel. So there's a thought for the inevitable. Well, actually, is it an inevitable sequel? Are you looking to build on this game, or what are you thinking for your next project? If you can talk about that.
I don't know. What can I tell him, Dan?
Just that. So we've kind of agreed that we're not going to talk about anything along these lines, other than confirming that Tom is already working on his next game, but we're not talking about what it is or how it relates to Axiom Verge, or even if it relates to Axiom Verge. So, we'll announce something when there's something a little bit more concrete to talk about. Sorry, I'm going to be a total buzzkill on that, but,
that's okay. I've dealt with PR before.
and you know, cause I think there's, you know, a lot of people have a lot of thoughts about what they would like the next game to be, if they're, you know, if it continues in the Axiom Verge universe. And, you know, everyone has ideas of, like, they like the fast travel, they don't like it, they, you know, they're, you know, they want more weapons, they want fewer weapons, they have, you know, new ideas. And one thing that I think is super important is, I think the reason that Axiom Verge turned out the way it did was because, you know, we talked a lot about consistency and the fact that Tom developed Axiom Verge entirely on his own. And I think the fact that there's a single creator of the game who has a vision for what it should be, is really helps a lot. And if you start talking about something too early, you start getting a lot of feedback from people, well-meaning people, but maybe people who don't know the full context of the game. And then you try to please a lot of people who don't really know what's, you know, what the overall final finished product is going to look like. So it's better to stay a little bit quiet for now, so like Tom can kind of solidify what it is he wants to do, and then do it. And then we'll start, you know, putting some more information out there. But kind of along those same lines, Tom and I have discussed the next project. And, you know, sometimes Tom will ask me for feedback, and I keep telling him that I'm afraid to give him any feedback because his design intuition is way better than mine will ever be. And so I'm always afraid of, like, giving him a suggestion that will turn out to be a bad idea and I've somehow ruined the game. So I keep telling him, like, you know, kind of let me know what's going on every now and again, but, you know, I want you to continue working on this the way, to the extent possible, the way you did Axiom Verge.
Okay, so you want me to make a multiplayer deathmatch? Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, and make it, if you can put lots of microtransactions in there, that would be great.
Here's a maybe a tough one from Travis Lowe. I have thought a lot about the world of Axiom Verge since finishing the game. This prompts my question. What books, ideas, philosophies, or what other art or media were most influential and formative for you in your life and in the making of this game? Thank you for making Axiom Verge. I haven't enjoyed this game, a game this much, for many, many years.
So for sure, I would say almost anything by Alistair Reynolds would kind of like give the flavor, or I don't know if it comes out in Axiom Verge, but it was, you know, the kind of thing that I was reading while I was making it. Greg Egan has some, you know, a series of books about people living in cellular automata that could be relevant. You know, it's not my favorite writing style in terms of like the characters and story, but there's big ideas to be had in those books. I really like the old television show Farscape. And I think,
wait, is that old now? What the hell?
It is old now. It is. Oh. Yeah.
Oh God.
Yeah. It's like 15 years old or something by this point. You know, standard definition. But it had a lot of really good visuals, I think. And that's, you know, in terms of like aesthetics, you know, obviously 8-bitified, but aesthetic wise, a lot of that I think found its way in Axiom Verge. And even originally the original version of Trace kind of looked a lot more like, John Crichton than the current Woody Allen looking type character.
So, actually kind of a follow-up to that from Jason. I have a question about the story in Axiom Verge. It has many similarities with a short story written by Robert Heinlein entitled By His Bootstraps. Was that an influence at all when creating Axiom Verge?
It was not. I've not heard of it.
Oh, well, I guess that's something for you to look up now.
Yes. Oh, and speaking of things that were not inspirations, BioShock Infinite, which I have never played, was not an inspiration. Someone accused me of stealing something from the plot in that game, and I didn't know that that was there. I'm sorry, BioShock Infinite devs. I did not mean to take anything from it.
From Kevin Boyer, I'd like to thank Thomas for creating such a wonderful experience and Dan for helping get it to the masses. Two of my favorite tracks on the soundtrack are Vital Tide and Inexorable. Can you share your influences for these tracks? Do you have any music that got left on the cutting room floor?
Cutting room floor. I think all of the tracks made it in except for that one that I think it was called Primordial Shores, and that you can get if you buy the soundtrack on Bandcamp. And that was going to be the soundtrack for like a kind of ocean themed area of the first level. So he said Inexorable and Vital Tide. I'm trying to remember which ones those are. I think a lot of it, I was listening to Hybrid at the time. Hybrid is a band. They also sometimes call themselves Hybrid Sound System. I haven't entirely figured out when they should be called what or in what context. I'm looking up the album. The album Disappear Here by Hybrid has a lot of songs that I liked, and I think you can probably hear hints of Formula of Fear and Can You Hear Me in those two tracks. I think also, like, going back to Farscape, there's one of those has some Indian vocals, and I was kind of trying to capture, if you know the Farscape, I don't know if it's the beginning theme or the end theme, has some vocals that are like alien wailing, and it always, I don't know, it seemed very evocative to me. You know, you never hear in movies what alien music would sound like, and I was trying to replicate that to some degree. Although I don't know if that's really something you would want to like listen to your iPod playlist.
So another one about the music from Justin. I don't know what I can say about the stellar design of Axiom Verge that hasn't already been expressed. It recaptured a specific sense of discovery and surprise I hadn't felt since the first Metroid. I didn't think that was possible. I'd love to hear more about the soundtrack. Did you have any experience creating music of this or any kind before? What kind of tools and software and hardware did you use? What was the most valuable thing you learned by the end of the process? That sort of thing.
So I had been writing music and learning more about it drip by drip since I was in college or so. I don't really play instruments. I think I had a couple of years of piano when I was in elementary school. And I I took a course on MIDI, of all things, back in like 1996. And everything I did after that was kind of just experimenting. I had, for a time, I made soundtracks to my game Ornn and for demo games that we had going on at a place I worked, Red Eye Studios, that were never sold commercially. So, you know, it kind of progressed from, you know, I could do just basic general MIDI. And then at one point I moved on to XM, you know, and that's what I used for Ornn. I used a tracker. And then for Axiom Verge, when it came out, virtual synths were a thing. And so for those who don't know, they're basically a plugin, a software plugin that mimics what actual music hardware would sound. So normally you'd have to go out and buy a big plastic keyboard filled with lots of sounds in order to get your sound. But processors started to get so fast that you could just do all of that in software. So for Axiom Verge, I purchased Sonar, I think it was Sonar X2, and all of that soundtrack was done with virtual synths. And that, you know, I did a lot of learning, I think, in, just in terms of how to use those, you know, how to use, because I had previously used basically effectively samplers, whereas these were simulated like analog, where there would be like a cutoff frequency and a resonance frequency, and you know, you could use, you know, additive or subtractive synthesis. And you know, there's a lot of that was new to me. And so when I think about the soundtrack to Axiom Verge, I think about like what it was like for me, like learning how to use those and that whole sort of world that opened up.
Comment from Andy Lennon. My main memory of the game is the wonderful music and sound design. It was deeply evocative and superbly married to the art style to form a compelling aesthetic blend. It was both deeply sinister and unsettling, whilst being simultaneously hypnotic. It engendered a real sense of isolation and significance. And as someone who values atmosphere in games above almost all other considerations, I thought it was one of the highlights of a fantastic experience. So you definitely have fans in the music area. Let's see. From Zach Adams, one thing I loved about Axiom Verge was the pervasive feeling that you're breaking a more straightforward game. The glitch graphics associated with the address disruptor, combined with the sheer weirdness of the areas that could only be accessed through its use, reminded me a lot of how breakable the original Metroid felt. Decoy Kraid felt like he didn't belong in the game. The hidden glitch areas accessible by sticking yourself in a closed door and going in and out of morph ball mode repeatedly clearly shouldn't have existed, and yet they added to the mystique of the game. Axiom Verge felt like it took that brokenness and turned it into part of the story, and I loved it. I never beat the last three bosses because I'm awful at platform shooters, but I loved every second of the 20 hours it took me to get to the point where I gave up. I also found Mr. Happ's PS blog article where when the Vita version shipped sad and fascinating, a really good and honest description of what it is to be a one-person dev crew relying on third-party tools when those tools stop existing. I'm glad I got to play the game on Vita, but I wish it hadn't ended up being such a brutal make-good. So for those of us who haven't read the PS blog, can you talk a little bit about that? What he's referring to?
I can only guess because it's been so long, but at the time the Vita version came out, it was a year after the PlayStation 4 version. And we had initially announced that it was going to be like simultaneously for PS4 and PlayStation Vita. But the issue was that I had written the game. It was originally written for Xbox 360 in the very beginning for XNA, and then Microsoft, of course, discontinued XNA. And then the only remainder was Monogame, which Sony had, I guess, contracted with Sickhead Games and Mono themselves to port Mono and Monogame to the PlayStation 4. And you know, they had thought, and I had thought too, that, you know, that it would be not too much trouble for it to be ported to Vita, cause Vita already had a C# programming language. I can't remember what it was called, but it was just limited by memory. And, I think it worked on like an earlier version of C#. But it turned out to be very problematic for Sickhead Games to make the port of Monogame to Vita. I think one of the issues was that Xamarin, the company that makes Mono, didn't want to make a Vita port of it, or they, you know, their price was too expensive. and so what Sickhead ended up having to do was make a cross-compiler between C# and C++. And oh my God, I'm probably making your eyes roll back in your head talking about this. But anyway, that process where he was doing, like, basically porting all of C# to the Vita, that took about a year for that to happen. And I think that was probably what that blog post was talking about. Yeah, but the good news is that same porting process is what allowed, you know, the Nintendo Switch and the Xbox One even to be made. So,
yeah, and I just looked up the blog post while you were talking, and the analogy you used was one of kind of like connecting a light bulb to electricity. So like basically, Sickhead Games had to kind of build the power grid and do all of this stuff. And then only finally, once the circuit was complete, like it went from, it doesn't run at all, doesn't work at all, doesn't do anything, to boom, the game's all done. Like, and you know, it's an oversimplification, but, because once it was boom, all done, there was still a little bit of tweaking that had to be done. But, for the most part, it went from, and I remember when we were going through this, it went from just, you know, Tom Spillman working on this compiler thing for a long time, and there was nothing to show for it. And then all of a sudden, one day, Axiom Verge was more or less fully playable on the Vita. So it went from nothing to very close to being done.
So one final question from Kormakur Gorarson, which actually kind of treads ground that we've covered a little bit already. But as Mark Brown pointed out in his Game Maker's Toolkit video on YouTube, Axiom Verge shares the bold trait with Super Metroid that it dares to let the player become lost, forcing them to find their own way. This is something many Metroidvanias shirk away from. How difficult was it finding that balance between exploration versus frustration?
I think it was a lot of trial and error, really. You know, you develop the game with best intentions in mind, thinking players are going to understand everything, but you really have to have people play test it and figure out what trips them up. Like I mentioned that anecdote with Jonathan Blow, which led me to making the room where I try to educate players that drills can drill through blocks that have cracks in them, and sometimes blocks that don't have cracks in them. And I think that was largely, you know, just watching where people got tripped up, informed where I, you know, did more quote unquote hand holding, just in terms of designing the game to where they were forced into a certain direction, as opposed to letting them be lost.
All right. Well, thank you for fielding all these questions. It was interesting to hear your additional thoughts on the development process. To wrap up this podcast, because it is getting kind of late, I was wondering if both of you or each of you could talk about, you know, just looking back at the entire Axiom Verge project and your respective roles in it and the time that you committed to it. What do you feel was your biggest accomplishment or the thing that you're most proud of with the game? And what do you think was the most difficult obstacle that you had to overcome? Dan, why don't we start with you?
Sure. So I think probably maybe just because it's the most recent thing that comes to mind, but probably the biggest accomplishment was getting the retail version out by the holidays. There was just a lot of things that had to fall into place. And of course, Badland is the publisher, but there were still a lot of things that just had to happen between us and Badland, and you know, things like shipping and exporting things from Japan, and working directly with Sony and Nintendo, and there were the packaging companies and all of these things. So
it's absurdly complicated.
Yeah, it took a lot, and it was a very stressful process, especially because, you know, we made the decision that, you know, come hell or high water, we wanted to get this thing out by holiday. And it took a lot of pushing and persuasion and kind of doing things that are not normally, you know, taking companies out of their normal comfort zones and getting them to compress their timelines. But we were able to get that done. So that, that was a very intense experience. And just seeing it physically, like when we got that video of it, you know, coming off of the line and being shrink wrapped and put into boxes, that was just like, wow, it's really happening. It's really, it physically exists in this world now.
Mm-hmm. And on the flip side, your biggest frustration or the biggest challenge you had to overcome in your part of the project?
The biggest frustration and challenge probably relates to getting the game out on Switch. It was very interesting that Nintendo was very enthusiastic about getting Axiom Verge on to the Wii U, and I should probably preface this by saying that if anyone who's listening to this doesn't know my personal history, I actually worked at Nintendo for about 9 years, and I ran the digital distribution / indie business that entire time. So I have long-standing personal relationships with all of my former coworkers over there, and everything was great going into the Wii U version. Everyone was really enthusiastic and excited. And when the Switch was still just kind of rumored, it was very early on. I really wanted to make sure that Axiom Verge could be either a launch title or a launch window title. I kept feeling like I was getting stonewalled and not let on to the platform. And that was a very frustrating experience, because had we gotten the dev kits a little bit earlier, since the game was already, for all intents and purposes, done, we might have been able to get it out by launch or in that first half of the year, as opposed to getting it out sometime in October, as it turned out. So that was probably the biggest disappointment. I think there was a time early on when there was just not enough content, and Axiom Verge could have stood out even more. But it's done very well on the Switch, so don't really have too much to complain about.
Okay. And Tom, your respective thoughts there.
For me, I think it's going to be a lot different from Dan. For me, like, actual game development, I wouldn't say it's necessarily easy, but it's what comes naturally to me. It's what I do, whereas you feel comfortable doing, Retronauts podcasts and, making these beautiful books, on games and editorials. For me, game development pretty much comes naturally, and there's not a lot for me to learn there, but all of the exterior stuff to it, like trying to get the word out, back when the game was just my hobby, trying to get it noticed by publishers. And then even once it had been announced and they showed the game at E3, just trying to emotionally cope with all this attention that the game had. This sort of being a semi, a niche public figure or whatever in the indie gaming scene, it was very overwhelming for me. I don't think there was much I could really do about it other than wait, get used to it over time. But definitely, Dan helped a lot. We got together I think, was it late 2014? He helped out a lot with a lot of the things that were question marks to me, how do I get people to know about the game? How do I get it in all of the places that it needs to be so that I can basically just work on the game and, not have all of this other PR marketing business type stuff making a big scary question mark over my head.
All right. Well, I think that does it. We've had quite a lengthy conversation, actually. So thank you both for your time. If you'd like to do the usual honors of telling us where we can find you on the internet, I guess it's a little different because you're not media personalities, but I'm sure, you're welcome to pimp your Twitter accounts or Facebook feeds or whatever. So go ahead, Dan.
So my Twitter is at Dan_Adelman. Last name is spelled Adelman.
And Tom?
My Twitter is at Axiom Verge. I do have a Facebook that I think is just facebook.com/ Axiom Verge, all one word, no spaces. But I definitely check Twitter more often, for better or worse. That's become the social media platform I'm most on. So yeah, at Axiom Verge.
All right. Well, that wraps it up for this Retronauts. As usual, I'm Jeremy Parrish. You can find me at retronauts.com, on Twitter as GameSpite. And let's see, Retronauts itself, you can find at retronauts.com, on the Podcast One Network, the Podcast One app, on iTunes, et cetera, et cetera. We publish weekly, so we'll be back next Monday with another full episode, and on alternating Fridays with a tiny episode. Thanks again, guys.
The Mueller Report. I'm Ed Donahue with an AP News Minute. President Trump was asked at the White House if Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation report should be released next week when he will be out of town.
I guess from what I understand, that will be totally up to the Attorney General.
Maine's Susan Collins says she would vote for a congressional resolution disapproving of President Trump's emergency declaration to build a border wall, becoming the first Republican senator to publicly back it. In New York, the wounded supervisor of a police detective killed by friendly fire was among the mourners attending his funeral. Detective Brian Simonson was killed as officers started shooting at a robbery suspect last week. Commissioner James O'Neill was among the speakers today at Simonson's funeral.
It's a tremendous weight to bear, knowing that your choices will directly affect the lives of others. But cops like Brian don't shy away from it. It's the very foundation of who they are and what they do.
The robbery suspect and a man police say acted as his lookout have been charged with murder. I'm Ed Donahue.